Good day and welcome to the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour, Episode 3. I'm James Gordon, and I'm part of the team behind a weekly community gathering focused on raising awareness and sharing ideas about important issues that concern residents of Guelph and beyond. Since the onset of the pandemic, we've been meeting virtually. And with that onset, it was so overwhelming for many that it was easy to forget that we were already at crisis point in a number of areas. We had a climate emergency, remember? Still do, sorry to say. And here in Guelph, housing was at crisis levels. One thing that didn't take a break while we were distancing and washing our hands, the opioid crisis. As you can imagine, it's even worse now, and that's the main focus of our gathering today with our two special guests, Rachelle Devereaux and Kate Nixon, who spoke to us on June 4th, 2020. Rachelle is the executive director of the Guelph Community Health Center, and Kate is a local activist and community organizer in Guelph, currently active with Your Guelph Downtown Friends. You'll hear Rachelle speak first about the priority population that her organization serves. You'll hear later from our moderator Dustin Brown, Guelph City Councillor Phil Ault, then Kate, then Hina Mystery, who is keeping her eye on the very active chat room that accompanies our meetings. Here's Rachelle.
In Guelph, our priority populations, or the priority populations of the Community Health Center, include individuals who are low income or live in poverty, those who are homeless or underhoused, newcomers and refugees, LGBTQ plus populations, individuals with diagnoses of mental health and addictions, and really a focus on those with moderate to severe mental health and addictions, folks with disabilities, vulnerable children and their families. And so what we do with those populations is we understand the population health metrics, or how many or what are the barriers that this population faces in our community. And our job, and the job of CHCs across this province, is to essentially tailor and design our services to reduce those barriers or to eliminate them, and to essentially ease access and to enhance health and well-being for those populations. And so what the services in each community are going to be different based on your priority population, and what the programs and services, how they come out, is really going to be also deeply informed by the clients themselves. So community engagement is critical. Population health data is really important. And then also a community development approach, which is really hearing from the voices of your community to design your care. So I once had somebody describe the Guelph Community Health Center as a boutique. And they were actually, I think, being a little cheeky with me. And I actually sort of accepted that as a compliment, because when you think about a boutique that you visit, you walk in and they say, "Phil, you're here. I know you love purple. I got you your purple tie." And so in the same way, that's the experience that we want when our priority populations, or our VIPs, as we call them, come in our doors. We want them to feel as though they are exactly where they're supposed to be, and that the programs that are there have been co-designed by them, for them, and that they meet their needs, which are unique to them. And so, so that is a service model or an approach to care that has been really important in the current overdose epidemic. We had a board meeting last night, and we were talking about the devastating numbers that we're seeing in our community. And we reflected that if 5 years ago we would have met as an organization, we would never have dreamed that we would have a consumption and treatment services in our building in downtown Guelph. And the reason that we wouldn't have dreamed that is because the need, the overdose acuity, or that overdose numbers, especially our mortality numbers, would not have told us that that was our work to do. And we were in a very different situation then. However, in 2018, in the winter of 2018, we began to see a concerning uptick in our overdoses in the community. And at the same time, we were seeing that across the province and across the country. And what we knew that to be driven by was unsafe drug supply, or tainted drug supply, particularly the presence of fentanyl in our communities. And it was really a beginning trend that we were seeing. And I'll say really sort of frankly, we hadn't been seeing people overdose in our building. We had always had preventative steps to, you know, to check in on people who may be using drugs in our bathrooms, or we may, you know, absolutely have been with our harm reduction supply programs that are happening here, have known that people were using drugs, but we weren't actually seeing overdoses in our space. In that winter of 2018, we saw three people overdose within the span of a week in our spaces. You know, we're a medical facility that has the privilege of having a medical team be able to quickly respond to a code blue, but that was different for us and began to tell us some information. We started to watch really closely and to connect with public health, who tracks the incident of overdose really closely in this community, and began to see some concerning trends. And what we know, and is no surprise to many of the activists and champions on this call, is that unfortunately when things go wrong, policy windows can open. And what I mean by that is that when things are in a crisis, unfortunately that turns the politicians' minds to we have to act because there's something really bad going on here. And so we know that in that winter of 2018 is when the policy window of overdose prevention sites opened, and those were short-term 3 to 6 month emergency programs that the Ministry of Health at the time had a relationship. What happened was the federal ministry, Health Canada, was deeply connected with the Ministry of Health on a provincial level, and there was an agreement between those two levels of government to expedite the fast opening of these overdose prevention sites, OPSs, and they were 3 to 6 month approvals that allowed us to respond to this emergency. With the data we had, the Guelph Community Health Centre partnered with Family Health Team in Guelph and with ARCH, the HIV/AIDS Resource and Community Health, and put in an application. The government, that policy window opening, the government told us, we'll be back to you in 14 days. And they kept that commitment. They turned around and said, Guelph, we see your numbers, we see what's happening, and you're approved to open an emergency overdose prevention site. And so we did that. In my volunteer resources office. So when things get decided quickly, you also have to find a space quickly. And we found a very small space at the front of our building and opened an emergency program. We maintained that program for 6 months. And then many of you know that in June 2018, we had an election and a change in government, and some things can change when governments change, including policies. And if you remember, Premier Doug Ford actually put in his election promise that he would commit to closing these sites. And so you can imagine our concern in July of 2018, when we're seeing overdose numbers climb even further, and that confirmation of, that we had that we were right, we did the right thing at the right time, amidst a time when the premier is saying, oh, not so fast, I think I need to undo this policy that the Liberals had brought in. Instead, we were incredibly pleased and relieved that what they did instead was a literature review and did a full review of the efficacy or the outcomes of these sites, because there was a lot of rhetoric that these sites cause problems. They increase drug use in the community. They cause increases in crime. And so they did a really deep dive on that that rhetoric, and they actually came to some really clear findings, recognizing that the health impacts and the lives saved balance any of the minor challenges that can happen in a community when the sites open. And really that aligned with what I had been saying for some time, which is we already have a fire happening in this community. We're building a fireplace around it. And so building the fireplace doesn't make the fire bigger. Building the fireplace around the fire actually helps to contain the fire, to reduce the harms of the fire. And so it's not a chicken or the egg discussion. It's really about building safety. So we, what the provincial government, the current conservative government did was they rebranded the program and actually made it less of an emergency-based approval. And they called it a consumption and treatment services program. And in the winter of 2018, we applied for that program and learned in March of 2019 after a really deep consultation with our community members, including a broad online online interview, really rich and interviews with our downtown business partners, and consultation, we were approved as one of the community, one of Ontario's 15 consumption and treatment services that were approved in that first wave. That was some relief, but also so much ambiguity. So just to give you a picture, we have nurses that are working in the site who, you know, on October 31st, don't know if tomorrow, November 1st, I'm actually going to still be approved. It was that level of timing that we were learning about these decisions, sort of waiting on the edges of our seats, but we're really pleased with how things happened. So we have been operating a formal consumption and treatment services since June of last year when we began to receive funding for that program. And what we operate is a program that's 7 days a week. It's staffed primarily by four regulated health professionals. And so we have a registered nurse who does street nursing, including Suboxone starts for folks who are looking for opioid replacement therapy. The registered nurse is also able to do wound care and triage. We're then able to connect people upstairs to our clinic who need broader, more comprehensive healthcare as well. And so often this is the first place that people are connecting around their health issues because they believe or they have went to places such as the hospital or their family doctor and been met with stigma and judgment and then chose to not go back to that system because it was too hurtful. We also have a peer, and for those on the call, it's I think many of you know this, a peer is an individual who has lived experience of mental health and addictions and so can really connect deeply and in real time with individuals who are struggling with addiction from that place and space of, I have been there. Not my journey is your journey, not you can get on the path because I've been on the path, but rather I'll sit with you and share the space with you because I've been in this space before. And I will create that safe space for you to just be. And when you're ready, and if you become ready, I'll talk about my journey with you if it's helpful. And so that peer has been instrumental to building relationship and trust within the team. We have a registered practical nurse who actually supervises the injections and actually oversees the individual using substances. The peer does the post-consumption work or the monitoring post-use. And then we also have a support coordinator or an individual who essentially, when somebody needs to go to the hospital because they have pneumonia, will go with the person to the hospital because they have pneumonia. We'll actually work with the nurses at the hospital to develop a plan that if this person has to be hospitalized, we'll help them get to the consumption and treatment services because they haven't gone to the hospital because they have pneumonia, because they're afraid they're going to go into withdrawal within the first 6 hours that they're there. And so this team really understands the folks and their struggles. However, consumption and treatment services doesn't get our community out of the woods. And we know that from the recent data that we've seen and the recent tragedies that our community has had to bear witness to, which have rocked our community, they've rocked our team, and they've really made us question to the core, how can we get out of this when we also are dealing with a health issue that is criminalized? And I think that you may or may not agree with me on that, but I will tell you, in my perspective, that is the pivotal issue here. We have a health issue that people that is criminalized and an illicit drug supply that is unsafe because of that criminalization. And so that's the very first thing that the Community Health Center is working on right now is a program called Safer Supply. What Safer Supply is, and I see a question earlier around some of the programs out of Van. Vancouver. I don't know if anyone ever looked at the Naomi Project, but it was a project, I think it was actually early 2000s that it came out, where it was prescribing heroin to folks who had addiction, and it was a dosed model where individuals who struggled with addictions were given a dosed amount of heroin, and there was great results out of it. But if you can imagine at the time, and even now, people like, you gave people heroin, like you gave addictions, folks who had addictions heroin. Yes, we did, because the alternative was overdose and death. And the alternative was these individuals spending 90% of their time drug seeking. And that's time that you can't spend doing other things in order to stabilize your life. And so there was a great shift in the country towards safer supply programs, and the community health center is actively leading this work and hoping to launch a safe supply program in the next couple of months under the leadership of a physician that we're actively hiring right now. That would look like prescribing to individuals a dosed amount of hydromorphone, which would then enable them to get their daily dispense. And then to provide them with team care to support them in getting connected to housing, housing, food, and other emergency needs. The really preliminary data out of London, Ontario, who started these, they're organic programs. There's capital S safe supply programs funded by Health Canada. I'm talking about grassroots developed programs where physicians say enough is enough. And I'm going to change my prescribing practices and build my team around me. The details out of London are showing remarkable changes in people's employment. Suddenly I have time because I'm stable. I actually feel well. I'm not in acute withdrawal and seeking substances. I'm not engaging in petty crime in order to be able to get my next fix. I'm actually knowing that at 2 o'clock and 5 o'clock, I get my dosed amount from my physician, and I have a team that's actually helping me to stabilize. In my perspective, it is it's healthcare with dignity for people with addictions. In this community, we're also sending out our outreach workers in integrated teams to do door knocks at the shelter system, which is now in the hotels at 90 Carden, as well as where folks are known to be sleeping rough, because we know people are being told to isolate and stay indoors. And so we need to outreach to them to say, hey, no, the consumption and treatment services is open. Come and see us if you need to. And to shift that and to give people naloxone and to let people know, no, it's okay to come out for healthcare, and to remind folks of that, because we are seeing numbers where we were seeing 20 to 30 visits a day at the CTS before the pandemic, now sometimes only seeing around 10. And so we know that that's being driven by some of that message that, yes, you need to stay indoors to keep you safe from COVID, but it's actually really impacting the way in which people are engaging with addiction services. And the other thing that we've done is we've added a third booth at the Community Health Center for our CTS services, because even though numbers are down, when the two booths were full, people still had to wait, and that was really acting as a deterrent. And so those are the things that we're doing on a local level, but actually I see Susan Watson on the call here, and she sent me a message after you, you may have seen that we received some some national news coverage in the Globe and Mail, and really encouraging, again, like, how are we going to use this, this unfortunate situation in our community to lobby for action? And so that lobbying for action would mean we aren't just going to have, you know, Dr. So-and-so and Dr. So-and-so do safe prescribing in Guelph. National Health Canada, we need safer supply, and we need it now, and we need it through authorized programs that physicians actually don't need to worry about, the fear of prescribing in a way that the College of Physicians and Surgeons might, you know, bear questions to, but you're actually going to regulate us in a broad and uniformed way, the way we have with consumption and treatment services. That's sort of the difference of, you know, there was some tents for overdose prevention sites that popped up, and now we call them consumption and treatment services, and they're formalized and they're funded. And that's what we're really advocating for, that we actually broaden that core program. And then we're also consulting with our local addiction services branch here in the Ministry of Health to look at having some expanded potential short-term sites in places that we know the overdoses are peaking right now. And so without going too far down that path until we actually have some more data from them, we're looking at it using this situation to, in a short term, surge our funding so that we can bring a team perhaps to Carden Street, bring a team perhaps to the motel system, so that we are reducing that barrier of people needing to leave and gain transport to get here. But in the meantime, we've had 8 deaths in this community since the beginning of this pandemic. That's 8 people that we've lost, that we've loved, that were loved, And we're standing behind that to say this is enough and we need change.
Okay, Rochelle, thank you for the fantastic and thorough intro. Phil, you have something to say?
Just a couple of questions, Rochelle, because I don't want us to get into a debate upon what safe supply is and so on. I was wondering, could you please explain what you mean by safe addictive drugs?
So really, and I have to always make sure I put the on the end. It's safer. It is not
safer.
It's not unanimously safe. But what the programs are prescribing is primarily different variations of morphine. And so that can be injectable or crushable, hydromorphone or again, just different variations. And what that is an actual, so morphine is a drug that's prepared by pharmaceuticals. And it's not prepared by somebody in somebody's basement tampering with carfentanil and figuring out how to do this thing for the first time. Rather, it's an actual regulated prescribed amount. In the same way that when I go to the liquor store, I know that when I read the bottle and it says that there's 21% alcohol in the vodka I'm buying, I know there's 21% alcohol throughout that bottle, rather than picking up moonshine, off the street. That's very different. And so that's what safer supply programs do, is they have a physician who actually is providing care to an individual, recognizing addiction as a health issue, and prescribing dose amounts of a substance to an individual in a way that they're able to manage their health issue through a consistent and regulated dose of opioids, and therefore are no longer needing to seek those substances and get access to carfentanil from the street. I can share a brochure for this group that you can distribute, Phil, that talks about London's model and some of those core ingredients to it. And Health Canada also did fund 5 programs across the country in their latest range. So again, this isn't rogue communities just trying something neat. These are physicians who have best practices and policies behind them to really guide a health-based program for addictions.
Thanks. I believe Dustin is now going to move over to Kate and to give her an opportunity to discuss her work. Is that right, Dustin?
That's right. So a lot of the questions that have been sent in, I think both of you have something to speak to on them. So I wanted to give Kate an opportunity to jump in. And Kate, if you can introduce your work with your downtown Guelph friends and other things that you've witnessed and done during the COVID-19 outbreak and what you're planning to do beyond, that'd be fantastic.
Thank you very much for having me, and thanks so much for everyone for coming. And yeah, so my name is Kate Nixon. I work in the downtown core with your downtown Guelph friends. Kinnery also does. She's here in this chat as well. And what we do basically is we play a friendship role within the downtown Guelph, and we work with migrants and folks that are substance dependent and overall low income, housing marginalized, etc. And we work from a anti-oppression base. And we believe that racism, classism, colonialism, ableism, gentrification, and capitalism are all factors in why we are in a housing and opioid crisis. So since this pandemic has started, we have lost a lot of lives. And these lives have been young people with dreams, thoughts, aspirations, and more. And their life was taken by something that could easily affect all of us. Addiction does affect us. If it hasn't individually, substance-dependent folks are in our community. They're our neighbors, our friends, our cousins, our grandma, your boss. They walk amongst you and your community, and we owe it to them to do better as a community and how we look at addictions. So the definition of addiction is a complex condition, a brain disease that is manifested by compulsive substance use despite harmful consequences. People with addiction have an intense focus on using a certain substance, such as alcohol or drugs, to the point that it takes over their life. Addiction is not a choice. It is a medical condition that people are suffering from daily. We know that the stigma surrounding drug addiction is one of class oppression, as there have been a lot of celebrities that have had substance dependent issues, and we don't see people openly call for violence against them like we do here in Guelph against housing marginalized folks. We see that there is a like open call for violence against people here that use substances and have housing that are housing marginalized, and we work around that, and we want to provide a community that is safe for everybody. So we believe in the four pillars drug strategy, and this is recognized by the Guelph Wellington drug strategy, the City of Vancouver Waterloo's drug strategy, etc. So the four pillars drug strategy is simple. It has harm reduction, prevention, treatment, and community safety. So harm reduction, the principles of harm reduction require that we do no harm to those suffering from substance abuse, and that we focus on the harm caused by problematic substance abuse rather than substance use per se. It accepts that abstinence is not a realistic goal for some drug users, particularly in the short term. Harm reduction involves an achievable, pragmatic approach to drug issues. Prevention includes supporting the development of programs and curriculum to educate folks about risks and benefits of substance use, offering family and individual mentorship programs that build resilience and protective factors. Treatment and recovery examples include recovery, supporting the development of both community and residential withdrawal management, so detox, and offering a variety of both inpatient and outpatient treatment services. And community safety, that one recognizes the need for peace and safety. It works to assist the community while protecting the vulnerable and preserving and protecting their life. This pillar includes working with local police services as well as the broader criminal justice system, the courts, probation, and parole. So it encourages like protecting folks at a level with the police and the justice system, and supporting individuals whose addiction has resulted in criminal persecution. So something that we also believe in, as Rochelle previously said, is the decriminalization of drug use, and that everyone should have somewhere to call home. We strongly believe that these two issues go hand in hand, and that if you provide everyone with a home, you will see that folks can manage their addictions well, and vice versa. And we also believe that housing is a right, and that's non-negotiable. Everybody deserves a place to call home at the end of the day, and we believe in safe supply and harm reduction, and we believe those are rights. So that's a little bit of what we believe. We also believe that housing everybody in turn will not only be better, not only is it like just the ethical thing and the right thing to do, it also from an economic standpoint, because I know that's how some folks, you know, operate at policy level from an economic standpoint, it's way more beneficial to house everybody. It approximately costs $50,000 a year per homeless person in Canada, and it's costing, I believe, like $7 billion per year for the so-called Canadian government. So in turn, if we provide housing for everybody, it's way less expensive. Not that like that should overtake the actual need for housing itself and why it's inherently a human right, but I know that when you talk to politicians and stuff, that usually is what it boils down to, which is really sad. But yeah, but also in Guelph here, so I want to talk a little bit about, I want to like amplify the voices of folks that I know that are my friends that are substance dependent, and sort of talk a little bit about some of their experiences here in Guelph. So folks that I talk to often say that because they don't have a place to call home, that they cannot curb their addiction. There's a lot of reasons as to why folks have addictions, like a lot of it's trauma based, and how they get into that system. A lot of it's anxiety, mental health issues. So they say like if they don't have a place to call home, it's a lot harder to curb it because you need to detox and stuff, right? And if you don't have a place to detox, you're not going to be able to curb that addiction. And we also believe, like, with decriminalization of drug use, the reason that we believe in that is because people are not going to come out and get access help because of fear of being persecuted by the police. I see that a lot here in Guelph. When I read the police reports, that a lot of the arrests being made are for possession of fentanyl and possession of, like, heroin and stuff like that. And to me, that's just not right. Nobody should be persecuted for a medical condition. And nobody should have to walk in Guelph in fear of being charged for a medical condition. And that's the reality of where it's of folks, you know, like, they're walking in Guelph and they're being targeted because they're a known substance user and they're being persecuted. And to me, like, I just think that that's just unacceptable. We're failing these folks at a policy level, and we're doing them a massive disservice by allowing this to partake in our community. People should have the right to be able to walk freely down the street without worrying about being persecuted for a medical condition. And really, when people get persecuted for drug use, they go through the incarceration system. So there's the mass incarceration of people that are substance dependent, and they're criminalized forever. They have a record. They, a lot of folks, like, have curbed their addiction since, but cannot get a job now because they have a record for possession of heroin or something like that. So it really ruins their life. They're being persecuted for a medical condition, and it has long-term consequences. And it's just, we're doing a massive disservice as a community, as a country, to these folks. And yeah, so we're really seeing the consequences of that, I think, here in Guelph. There's a lot of folks that feel, that don't feel safe walking these streets. They're scared that they're going to be targeted by the police. They are scared that they're going to, like, never be able to have some sense of what they deem, like, a normal life. Like, they can't just go out and get a job. These folks are being failed at a policy level, at a community level, in terms of, like, police and stuff. But I think that, like, I really tip my hat off to all the harm reduction workers, and all the folks at the health center, Hope House, Sanguine. They're doing a really amazing job, and it's such a hard situation, right? Like, it's, how do you, like, navigate through that when it's something that's criminalized and there's so much stigma surrounding it, and, you know, providing services to these folks when, like, navigating through all that, I think is really, really amazing. And I just have a lot of respect for all the folks here in the community that are doing that work. It's just safe supply for all, decriminalization. I think there needs to be more social workers than police. I think having, I'm very openly not satisfied with the new pilot project that is taking place downtown. And I know that people, like, don't feel comfortable having that conversation, but I think it needs to be said. There are 5 downtown resource officers, and I think that there could have been room for 4 additional social workers downtown. And I think that by doing 4 more police officers downtown, that we are again doing a massive disservice, because their job is to basically patrol downtown and to find things, you know, that are going against the law, and drug use is against the law. So basically their job downtown is to criminalize these folks, and these folks, like, this is their downtown, is their home. Like, we're literally, when we walk down there, and folks that don't have homes, you know, we're walking in their living room. And I think it's just very sad to see that they can't escape being persecuted, you know. And, like, now it's, the level of police presence is upped, and there are huge consequences because of that. I think we're going to see folks scared to come out and access services. I think we're going to see folks scared to, like, you know, to walk downtown. And I think that there's risks to that. Like, there's consequences in the terms of, like, we might even see more overdoses happening and stuff like that, because, like, they're scared of accessing these services in fear of being arrested for possession. So there are definitely things here in our community that we can advocate for at this level here, just in Guelph, that would make life a lot easier for folks who are substance dependent. And yeah, I think that's pretty much all I had to say. Yeah, I think that was it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Kate. I want to make a brief space for reflection on the 8 people in our community who have died as a result of the opioid crisis since March. Okay, thanks everyone. So there were a number of questions that were sent and suggested in advance to bring to both of you, and a lot of them had to do with institutional supports. But I'm seeing in the chat, Morgan recommended talking about the Portugal model and asking, can we move to that as a city? I'm going to use my limited knowledge of municipal governance and say that we can't decriminalize all drugs right now as a city. I think that's true. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. But what I will say about that is that a lot of what happened in Portugal was cultural first, from my understanding. So there were a lot of cultural shifts that kind of culturally decriminalized drugs before the institutional changes came into place. So we have limited time left because both of you were so thorough in your introductions, and I really appreciate that. So I'm going to kind of delay the institutional questions and move on to some individual ones. So first I'll just generally ask both of you, what can people do to sort of instigate those cultural shifts that need to occur in order to make space for the institutional shifts that people are thinking about?
I can suggest that, with the very important movement on Black Lives Matter, one of the things that we're calling to each other is to speak up when it's uncomfortable, to stand up, to acknowledge your privilege, and to shift some of your privilege to those who don't have that. And that it's our job, not the job of those who are marginalized, to lead that. I think that that something similar applies in the wake of the overdose crisis, is that it is something for us to have a moment of silence this morning. And I think that that's really important. But what else are you going to do? And what are you going to write to? And you're right, Dustin, it's Health Canada and the federal government that sets the Controlled Drugs and Services Act that says what's legal and what's not. And so, you know, what are you going to do to write to your federal member of parliament to say this needs this needs to be called into attention? What are you going to do to write to Lloyd Longfield and say your health ministry, congratulations, thank you for 5 safe supply programs in the country? But Guelph didn't receive funding for that, and we are, you know, suffering the consequences of that right now in our community. And so I do think that sometimes we can do the small thing and feel like that's enough, but I'm really imploring, if you are prepared to take action through advocacy, through lobbying, but also through the day-to-day moments of kindness that you can take in this community to let our community members know that they're worth it. Because that is something that can, even in the moment, provide an ounce of hope to individuals who don't have that right now. I just got to know somebody when I came in who loves butter tarts. And we shared a moment about butter tarts, and we talked about, I love butter tarts too. And, you know, and you're a guy who likes sweets, and so am I. And you have experienced adverse childhood trauma. And that's why you sit in somewhere different than I do this morning. So I think also really understanding why addiction happens and standing up in your community when you see online bullshit happening in forums that are calling people out for making choices and decisions and how should we support these junkies, stand up and say that's a not, like that's enough. Be an online warrior and challenge your community members. And that is how we can shift our culture through, you know, through communication and through openness and through through helping to use your influence as leaders in this community, as people with respected voices, to engage in discussion to shift the perspective of shift the perspectives of others. Our mayor had a very different perspective about the consumption and treatment services when we opened. He would not disagree or hide behind the fact that he called me and said, Rochelle, not in my downtown for long. And now he welcomes other communities and openly says that that was my perspective, but I came, I learned, I saw, I shifted my perspective, I engaged, I met people, and now I am the biggest champion for this. And he helped alongside the counselors on this call to lead a unanimous vote for it to stay. And so change is possible, but it has to come from somewhere. People have to be the influencers, and I call on you to be the influencers.
Okay, do you have anything to add in regards to that question?
Just something really brief. I think something too as well, like just acknowledging that like oftentimes folks with substance dependency issues are facing dehumanizing language and conversations surrounding them. And I think just doing something as simple as like if you see somebody on the street who's struggling, or you come across somebody who like is panhandling or something, I think like even just talking to that person, like I see Morgan here says that she has a brief conversation with everyone she meets. I think that that's super impactful, because a lot of times like folks are really well aware of what is being said about them on community forums. Like I think there's like such a people always think that they can just openly say things against folks that are addicted and not have not face the consequences of their actions and words. But oftentimes these folks are seeing what people say, and they'll tell me and that they see this and like they're really upset by it. And I think that if folks just really like come out and show them love and support, I think that that can even be revolutionary in itself in a society where drug use is still heavily stigmatized. And, you know, I think that even that can be revolutionary in itself, and also advocating at a municipal level as well. Asking questions about the current state of the downtown, like why do we have more police, you know, asking those questions, because I think that those are really important questions. Like, why aren't there more social workers downtown? Why is it all police? Like, why can't we, like, why is there like a criminalization element downtown when we could be having a more supportive element downtown, walking the streets, walking a beat, you know? And I think that like we have two wonderful Welcoming Streets Initiative folks. I would like to see more of that. I think that that is important. So I think talking on a municipal level and also advocating at a federal level for decriminalization, like Rochelle said, is super important as well. And just having those tough conversations with folks in your community about why these folks, you know, are like deserve to be treated with respect, because a lot of people, you know, like don't feel that way. And I think just having those tough conversations, and like even it's interesting that Rochelle mentioned that with all that's happening with Black Lives Matter stuff, because one of the things that a lot of folks are asking is for the end on the war on drugs at a policy level with Black Lives Matter. So that's something that it's actually like something that people are bringing up a lot, because oftentimes drugs are used as a way to target marginalized communities and racialized communities as well. And I think it's important to talk about that.
Great. Thank you, Kate. So I'm gonna move on to some of those institutional questions now. The first of which is, what local organizations are at the forefront in supporting those seeking help with mental health and addictions?
So one of the things that is really amazing in Guelph, again, I think you all know this, is deep partnership and collaboration at the social and health service level. And so it really is a united effort. We work really closely. So we have the Welcoming Streets team that Kate just mentioned is two frontline peer outreach workers who support downtown businesses and individuals who are struggling with mental health and addictions in the downtown area. That program is funded by United Way, the Downtown Police Services Board, by the Downtown Business Association, by the Ministry of Health, and so all, and by the City of Guelph. So there's five funders who say this is important to us and we commit to funding this model. The employees are employed by us, but they're working in deep collaboration with the outreach workers from ARCH, from CMHA, and from our partner organizations. So when I think about the organizations that work the most closely together on this issue, without question, it's the Drop-In Center in Wyndham House. So because we know that homeless folks are disproportionately impacted by addictions. You're using more substances to manage your homelessness. And in fact, the more marginalized you are, the more likely you are to struggle with addiction challenges. So we know that. We also work really closely with Stonehenge Therapeutic Community, with CMHA in Guelph, our mental health organization. And so the SOS team has a nurse from the community health center and peers from the community health center and an addiction counselor from Stonehenge. And they truly act as one service. So when the person is met by the counselor, nobody says, oh, you work at Stonehenge, don't you? They're like, you're SOS. And so that's really what an integrated partnership is, where it's like act as one service, even if you're employed by or funded by different sources. And then ARCH and Sanguin are incredibly important in harm reduction services and in really providing that wraparound care model as well. And so those outreach workers, when I say we're going out and doing those door knocks, sometimes what can happen when there are five employers and five different workers is, you know, Jenny talks to Steve and Steve talks to Joe, but we don't know. Did somebody talk to Joe and did somebody talk to Steve? That's not actually connected. And so what we're really working on is creating one team with one shared note-taking record where we know, oh yeah, you talked to Steve. So now I'm going to follow up with Steve and I can see what you've done. So it's actually what's called continuous care and wraparound care, as opposed to sometimes what can be fragmented. So really bringing those multiple positions together to act as one service and to be more coordinated in the community. So that work is underway and it's happening. You know, when we, I don't know if you know this, but last week there was a really concerted effort to do COVID-19 testing at 90 Carden. And so that happened via the Sanguin van. I had multiple staff on that van. So too did our partners. And we went down and implemented a testing strategy. All of those tests came back negative.
So I'm going to ask... I'm going to go back to a couple of things that we talked about, both the East Van initiatives that have occurred and the Portugal model. If either of you have knowledge on those and would like to expand on them and maybe delineate some differences that Guelph has, you know, structurally, culturally, you know, what's preventing us from getting here to there, that sort of thing. I'll let that be kind of an open-ended question.
Sure. I had the privilege of visiting Insight, of course, the foundational consumption and treatment service here in Canada. And absolutely, the need is broader than it is in Guelph. And so the service is bigger than it is in Guelph. But one of the things that's distinct from the Guelph model from Vancouver is detox is right upstairs. And you'll see through Donnie, if anyone follows Donnie Hay and the group that are working towards a medical detox here in this community, sometimes there can be a bit of a rhetoric of this or that. And I think our policy makers and funders put us into that. You know, what's more important? Do we need treatment or harm reduction? Do we need upstream work on adverse childhood experiences to prevent trauma? Or do we need, downstream consumption and treatment services? We need it all. As Kate said, it's a four-pillared approach, and no one pillar is going to get us out of this crisis. But if we could have our way, we would absolutely have more integrated options for treatment without wait times. Because so many times people come in and say, I'm done. Enough. I'm exhausted. This life is breaking me down. I'm ready. And when they are ready, it is almost a miracle if there's a service available for them right at that moment. And so our team often holds these folks in limbo, calling over to Kitchener to see if the bed opened up. And then by the time 3 days pass and there is one, the person's gone back out because it's hopeless and this is a frustration. That can happen as well for our treatment providers. When I'm ready for a 21-day program, we know oftentimes people are waiting upwards of 3 or 4 months to get entry to that. What happens in 3 or 4 months is a lifetime when you're dealing with such an inherent struggle. And so Safe Supply can help in that model where it can actually give people a bridge to treatment programs and actually is treatment. But I absolutely think that we need to be advocating for programs to boost that treatment side of the continuum of the pillars and really make sure that the help is there to actually address their addictions when they're needing to.
The Portugal model it's actually interesting because the reason that like Portugal came to where it is today is out of a crisis, and it was out of necessity. Portugal had the highest HIV rate in all of Europe at the time that it decriminalized drug use, and they were having a lot of issues with folks, you know, dying and stuff. And they recognized that it was a crisis and that there was something that needed to be done. So I know that a lot of people at the time, you know, were saying like, how stupid is that? Like to decriminalize drugs and, you know, that's just going to add to the problem and stuff. But actually all the rates went down. I don't have the exact numbers, but like, I know that there were statistics that showed like, the amount of overdoses went down, the amount of deaths went down, the HIV rate went down, and that was because folks acknowledged that this was indeed a medical crisis, and that this was a health issue, and that they addressed it as such, rather than this is a criminal element, this is something that needs to be punished, you know. So that was it was just a shift in their mentality that kind of led to this. And they also recognized that this was a crisis and folks were dying because of negligent policies. So I think that like, that's very attainable and feasible for us here. It just takes a bit of shifting of our sort of like ideology surrounding drug use to recognize that this is indeed a medical issue. And this is not a criminal element like many folks think.
Okay, thank you both. I'm going to now pass things over to Hina. I know that there have been a lot of good questions in the chat. So we have until 9:10, 9:15 for questions from the chat. And I'm going to let Hina bring them up in a way that makes sense.
Okay. So I've been keeping track of, like Dustin said, like some of the questions were answered by the speakers as they came up. So I've tried to mark down which ones we've already taken care of and which ones we have yet to go. But Morgan asked a question that Rochelle addressed in the chat, but just for those who are on the phone, like I was wondering if we could maybe repeat and talk about this. So Morgan asked, when a person is barred from entry to CHC downtown due to a trespass order, are they able to access the other locations?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And it's a challenge that we work on all the time, which is balancing access to care while simultaneously balancing the health and safety of our staff and other visitors. Rarely does an individual come into our space and overtly threaten the safety of my staff or volunteers. I can actually tell you in the last 3 years, that has not happened. But what unfortunately does happen are things such as, pretty escalated conflict between visitors that can be, you know, really threatening, or somebody in really acute mental health or addictions crisis behaving in a way, perhaps with weapons, etc., that threaten the health and safety of our individuals. But generally, when we're talking about a service ban, we are not talking about somebody who, for behavioral reasons that we are designed to serve, we've decided, you know, your behavior, your mental health or addictions issue is that complex. We're generally talking about people who have, stolen a car or, done something so significant in terms of a threat to our security that we actually need to consider a short-term leave from our space. And so the way those decisions are made is the person's healthcare team is fully engaged in that and consulted on how do we make sure this person still gets access to healthcare if we issue this ban? How do we make sure their prescriptions are still met? How can we bring our team out to them in a way that they're still safe while still acknowledging the behavior? I am part of the review team and I am regularly reviewing bans. So we had a significant theft 3 weeks ago, and I just met with the person yesterday and asked them to do 5 acts of kindness and come back to me with a checkpoint at the end of the week. You know, we really are trying to think about creative ways to bring people into care and to care for them. However, there are still people who cannot come to our building from time to time, and they typically cannot go to our other spaces because the issue is that of health and safety of our staff or of security. But we do review those and always will review them on an ad hoc basis if somebody comes forward and says, hey, this situation happened. I've got a lot of regret about it, but I want to make things right. And can I figure out a way to do that? We will always look at it every single time. And so I just encourage you, Morgan, to flag Premier follow-up with me if there is anything specific that we need to look at. Another thing just to know is that we are really connected across, like I talked to you about Gail at the drop-in center and others and Jaya. So if there's somebody who's on a bit of a tear and causing a bit of challenge in our spaces, we'll often do our plans for people are called welcoming plans, which is how can we take this person's inherent needs and make sure that they're met in our space so that their behavior might actually not escalate. So I have somebody who loves to be in charge and in power, and don't we all? And so when he comes in the building, I'm like, okay, is it time to meet with the board? Like, even if he's behaving really badly or struggling. And so we really try to figure out how do we create care that meets your needs and that reduces that risk to our team at the same time. And welcoming plans are one of the ways.
I guess maybe we'll move on to the next question just in the interest of time. So both Sheila and Juanita asked how many were tested at 90 Carden.
I just got booted off, but I'm back on by my phone. So it's Rochelle talking, and there was between 30 and 40 people tested at 90 Carden.
Okay. I'm going to pass it over to Dustin now for some additional stuff.
Cool. Thanks, Gina. Our apologies to anybody who asked a question that didn't get posed. We're doing our best in everybody's interest of time. There are a lot of great questions, but we can't get to all of them, unfortunately.
No, we can't. That's all the time we have for this week. Though I should say that there was a great interest in this topic, so the virtual discussion went on for quite a while. Special thanks to the Breezy Breakfast team of Phil Ault, Dustin Brown, Tanya Gevert, Hina Mistry, Sequoia Kim, and our many supporters who gather every Thursday at the unkind hour of 8 a.m. Music for the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour is by Jules Germ. If you'd like to join us or you have any questions, email me, James Gordon, at james@jamesgordon.ca. Thanks for listening.